This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
You may have noticed, but in the last few months, we've been talking a lot here about history. It's not because history was my favorite class, however, spoiler alert, it was. But it's because out of all the academic classes and programs, history pretty much has the best stories.
I think the function of history is what Dr. Samuel Johnson described as the function of literature, and history is literature, among other things, namely better to enjoy life and better to endure it. And in that sense, a knowledge of history can help get you through anything.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a teacher who has spent his entire career and most of his life learning and telling stories about history. We'll also spend an academic minute exploring the problems some historians have when researching the history of slavery. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. It was pretty obvious from an early age that David Kaiser was heading full speed ahead into a life in history. He wrote a comprehensive history of the United States during some snow days in fifth grade, so yeah, history was his first crush. Over 60 years later, he talks about his career as a professor and researcher in the new book, A Life in History. Dr. David Kaiser is an historian who has taught at Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, the Naval War College, and Williams College. I asked him why he turned his research skills around and focused on himself.
Well, I thought I had a story to tell. I had done a dry run of this more than 10 years ago. After I spent the academic year 2006-07 at Williams College. That was a very intense experience, as I described in A Life in History. And I had kept a journal during that year, and I tried to turn the journal into a book, adding sections on the previous phases of my career. And I showed it to my agent at that time, and he liked it, but he said, why don't you wait until you can integrate this into a full-scale memoir? And that's what I decided to do. And once I got into it, it turned out to be a pretty compelling project. I thought I had an interesting story to tell on my own behalf, and I also thought that I had important things to say about what had happened to the historical profession and the discipline of history during the time that I was in it, and that could arouse a good deal of interest as well. And apparently, I was right about that based on what's been happening with the publicity campaign that we've been having.
Well, going back to the writing of the book, how do you compare researching your own life as compared to researching some historical figure?
Well, some of it was the same insofar as I had a great many primary sources to draw on. I had virtually all the material from my own education. I had thrown out very little. I had all the notebooks in which I had taken lecture notes as an undergrad and a grad student, the papers I had written, et cetera, et cetera. I had course syllabi from the courses I had given. I had some students' work, et cetera. But I've also been blessed or cursed with a very good memory ever since I was a kid. It has often surprised people, and it continues to do so when even to surprise me. So it was easier in that respect, and it moved along quickly. I was also delighted by the response I got from the former students whom I asked to contribute to the book. One of the things I've always been proud of is that I'm still in touch with students from every stage of my career, going back to the 1970s, and they did contribute a lot that was very important, and some things that really surprised me with respect to what they remembered. So it went a good deal quicker, certainly, and there wasn't a separate research stage, let's put it that way. I'm researching a book now on the politics of the Gilded Age, and I would guess that I'll spend at least a year just doing the research before I start writing at all. Writing A Life in History wasn't like that.
Well, it seemed very early on you were comfortable in the classroom.
It was the place that I was the most comfortable, yes, from the time that I was a child, and that stayed with me all my life.
You had a lot of early success. In fact, I was reading this going, how did you do that? Because I had a much less successful academic career.
Well, it was just very natural for me, and it was where I felt most at home. And I suppose, too, that being the top performer or one of the top performers in the class became an important part of my identity really early on, so that was a concern for me. And I spent a lot of time outside of the classroom learning, even during the times, and there were such times when, for whatever reason, I wasn't as focused as I usually was in the classroom.
When did you notice that your interest was going to be history?
Oh, well, certainly, I think that goes back to elementary school, as I explained, and certainly to that emerged in fifth grade where we had that blizzard in Albany. Some other of your listeners might remember that. That was in the winter of 57-58, and we had a whole week off from school, and I wound up writing a history of the United States, which I still have. So at that point, I think it was pretty clear.
What is the difference between researching and writing a book about history and researching and getting up in front of a class and teaching it?
Well, when you are researching, and if you love researching, which I do, you are getting lost in a different world. And I find myself getting interested in everything. For instance, right now, what I'm doing is something that I've done with other projects. I've got one source, which is a weekly newspaper, The Nation. And I'm simply reading it through, not every word, but all the relevant stuff from week to week, and just getting totally immersed in the late 1870s, early 1880s. And that's a wonderful experience for me, for whatever reason. And you get to know this cast of characters and so on. So I always say to everybody, there are three stages to a project. There's the research, which is pure joy. Then there's the writing, which is also fun, but it's also not, it's not pure fun. Then comes the point where you get to the end of the manuscript and write the end. And after that, things aren't so much fun anymore, in my experience, although they can still be satisfying. But getting up in a classroom is the opposite, in that to have a successful class, which is going to only last an hour or two, or actually at the War College we had 3-hour classes, you have to make a lot of decisions about what's important and what isn't. You have to have a plan. As I explain, because of some of the experiences I had as a student and early in my career, I was always determined to cover the material that I planned to cover in the class. And if you're going to do that, you have to make a lot of decisions. You have to edit. But if you do that, it will give your students a very positive feeling about the class.
A life you spent in academia, but tell me the difference, if you could, between the universities you've worked in and the Naval War College. Because it seemed like it was a different experience.
It was a very different experience. The wonderful thing about the colleges and universities I taught in was the undergraduate students and the experience I could have with them, and the freedom to design my own courses. The wonderful thing about the War College was that I was part of a cooperative enterprise. I belonged to something called the Strategy and Policy Department that was teaching a course that eventually became two different courses called Strategy and Policy, or Strategy and War. And I had a wonderful group of colleagues, both civilian professors like myself and military colleagues. We were all involved in the same material. The courses were very challenging. They covered the history of warfare from the Greeks until the present time. Every week, there were a lot of fascinating issues to grapple with, and we were working together. And the students were very conscientious. I had wonderful relationships with some of my students, although they're not the same kinds of mentor relationships that you can get into with various undergraduates, as I did. But that was the strength of it, was that it was a cooperative enterprise. It was very organized in a way that civilian academia definitely is not. And also, we felt we were contributing in our own way to the national security of the United States by teaching officers to think about very important questions.
You were at the War College. You described this in the book, on 9/11. Could you describe that experience there and what changed at the college after that?
That was quite a day. This was before the age of Wi-Fi, when cell phones were just getting going. And that morning was one of our teaching mornings when I was teaching a 3-hour seminar that began at 8:30 in the morning. And nothing had happened at 8:30. And we taught on the Napoleonic Wars, it was, as I recall, until 10. And then, as we always did, we broke for 10 minutes for coffee. And it was only at that moment that we discovered what was happening in the world. Both of the towers had been hit. We began watching TV. I was very interested to notice that my military colleagues, the military faculty and the students, who are trained to handle emergencies and who have been in emergencies shut down completely emotionally. And watching TV, I saw the collapse of the towers, and then shortly we were sent home. The long-term impact on the college wasn't very good, I'm sorry to say, although my old colleagues are still doing their job and doing it well. The whole college got much more present-focused. Instead of focusing on history as a way to have new thoughts about the present, we began looking for things that we could teach from the past that seemed to be relevant to the new situation that we were in. Also, I don't know if this was because of 9/11, but the Pentagon suddenly got much more interested in exactly what we were doing and imposed its own set of requirements. That wasn't too big a help. But in general, history really thrives in relatively quiet times politically and in times of political consensus. And it thrives when there is a more or less agreed idea of the truth. And that's the kind of period that we were having in the 50s and 60s, which then was opened up to a large extent, I'd say, in the 70s when I was beginning my career, which was a wonderful time to be in my career. Now, as we know, we're fighting over what truth is. Everything is up for contention. Views are much more partisan, and it's much harder to do or teach good history in that kind of environment, although I don't think it's impossible, and I continue to try to do it, and I'm continuing to try to do it in print.
Still to come, our conversation with David Kaiser continues as we talk about history repeating itself over and over again. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is David Kaiser, an historian who taught at Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, the Naval War College, and Williams College. We're talking about his new book about his career called A Life in History. I asked Dr. Kaiser if sometimes knowing so much about history can be a bit of a curse as you watch people and governments making the same mistakes over and over.
You can get frustrated about that, but I think the function of history is what Dr. Samuel Johnson described as the function of literature, and history is literature, among other things, namely better to enjoy life and better to endure it. And in that sense, a knowledge of history can help get you through anything. Now, one of the things I talk a lot about in the book, as you know, is the influence on me of William Strauss and Neil Howe, two amateur historians who 25 years ago, identified a pattern in American history of an 80-year cycle, and they noticed that every 80 years there was a great crisis. They noticed the American Revolution, and then 80 years later the Civil War, and then 80 years later the Depression and the Second World War. And then, back in 1991, when they wrote their first book, they said, they did the math, and they said, in the first 10 or 15 years in the 21st century, we're going to be in another great crisis. And guess what? That prediction came true. And having that background, having assimilated that theory, used it in a couple of books, that does make it easier for me to get perspective on what we're going through now, although it doesn't make what we're going through now any less disturbing.
Are historical milestones, and you have the 80-year thing, but there are some in between also. Are historical milestones always obvious as they're happening, or is it usually in retrospect?
That's a very good question, which I would have to think about a good deal to give a detailed answer. I would say it's about 50-50. Looking at my own life, there wasn't any question that the Vietnam War was rap and associated events were becoming a very important historical milestone while it took place. By 1970, when I was only 23, I guess, I was very keenly aware that we were living in a different America, and we probably weren't going back to the one that I had known before that. On the other hand, the campaign of Barry Goldwater, a little earlier in 1964, just looked like a blip on the political curve, which seemed to be going in the generally liberal direction. Interestingly enough, one man who saw that it was more than that was Theodore White, who wrote the Making of the President series. And if you look at the end of the Making of the President, 1964, he actually predicted that Goldwater could turn out to be the start of something big. And boy, did he turn out to be right. So I guess the answer to your question is it depends. And sometimes we do see it, but sometimes we don't see it at all.
How did you find, and I guess they were your students, how did you find the students who wrote their remembrances of you?
Most of them I had been in touch with more or less all along. Not necessarily frequently, but most of them I had never lost touch with. There was one fascinating exception to that, which I'm still shaking my head over, which is a woman named Claire McHugh, whom I did remember, but who was a freshman in the last iteration of my big lecture course in Harvard. That would have been in the spring of 1980, and I remembered her and her roommate sitting in the front row. I hadn't had much contact with her outside of class, and I hadn't had any contact with her since then. But through a mutual acquaintance, and just about the time I was starting to write the book, about 2 years ago, I found that she remembered me, and in fact that she had never stopped thinking about some of the lessons she had taken from that course. And so we reconnected, and we've been having frequent discussions and discussions about a historical novel she's writing ever since. And one thing that really struck me was that she said one of the biggest, she became a journalist, by the way, and she said one of the biggest things that stuck with her about my approach to history as revealed through my lectures was how important I thought individual people were in making decisions. And I certainly do think that, but it was quite a shock to learn that she felt she had gotten that from me, but she hadn't gotten that very much from other people during her Harvard education in the early 1980s. But in general, as I say, I had been in touch with him, and in a couple of cases, for instance, one of the ones from Williams College, Ollie Tozier, was a little surprised to hear from me, but also very glad to do so, and she contributed very nicely.
I assume you had no input into what they wrote.
I didn't. No, not at all.
Right. You didn't say, you better be good to me or you're not in the book.
No.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that, and I really, really enjoyed this part, is that you quoted the end of your teaching career from the book Ball Four. You just wrote a parallel to that, which is on my Mount Rushmore of all books.
Oh, yes. Well, we have that in common. And yes, and I'll quote that last line when Boughton's career is over and he hears about another pitcher who's pitching in an amateur league. And he thinks, well, would I do that? Would I be pitching in an industrial league? And he says, well, yes, I would. And then he says, you see, you spend a good piece of your life gripping a baseball, and in the end, it turns out it was the other way around all the time. And again, it's amazing. That's like From Here to Eternity, which I read when I was even younger. I read that when I was 23, when the book came out, and it had a tremendous impact. But I didn't know how closely that was going to be describing me in my own life at that time.
So you figure history is just going to have a hold on you till the end?
Oh, no doubt about it. Right. As W.E.B. Du Bois said in the quote that I used at the very end of the book, it's great watching the unfolding of events, even though one misses the end.
Again, the name of Dr. David Kaiser's new book is A Life in History. You can learn more about the book at mountgreylockbooks.com or at alifeinhistory.com. Slavery is perhaps the biggest stain on the history of the U.S., and historians looking for facts and stories about that time face a number of challenges. That is the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The stories of enslaved individuals in the U.S. are still being told. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Susanna Ashton, professor of English at Clemson University, explores the story of Samuel Williams.
There are stories of and about slavery, but history gives us few voices of actual witness and survival. Over the last 20 years, my research has focused on looking at North American slave narratives and asking questions about the backstories that enabled remarkable memoirs to come into being. One of these is Before the War and After the Union, an account of a childhood under slavery in South Carolina, penned by a Samuel Alexon, who showed up on no known historical records until his family revealed to me his true identity. As a child, he saw his mother's and sister's sold, and was forced to go to war under a Confederate officer. After emancipation, he was reunited with family, finished his education, registered to vote, and moved north for new opportunities, where he penned his autobiography. Not only did he publish his memoir under a pseudonym, he changed the names of most of the white families he wrote about and slightly altered other telling details, most likely to protect his extended family, many of whom remained in South Carolina. Even though he may have been concerned about offending certain individuals, that concern did not override his determination to share his truth. After all, Williams wrote his book during the early 20th century and was not concerned with combating slavery, but was instead concerned with combating forgetfulness. So much of our nation's history has been to erase individual voices and deny the humanity of people who suffered displacement, genocide, or slavery. And yet, in this one modest case, thanks to the outreach and generosity of his family, we can share Samuel Williams' real name and let others know how he triumphed over suffering and made sure that his witness would forever matter.
That was Susanna Ashton of Clemson University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.